The Secretary General of the Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement says the resistance would not remain silent in the face of the Israeli regime's efforts to plunder the country's maritime gas resources. Saeed Hassan Nasrallah made the remark on Thursday after a vessel operated by a Greek company arrived at the Karish gas field in Lebanon's territorial waters to extract gas for the occupying regime. Nasrallah noted the enemy does not recognize the international law and resolutions, reminding that it was not the international regulations, but actually pressure, war of attrition, and resistance that forced the occupying enemy to retreat from the southern Lebanon and the Palestinian enclave of the Gaza Strip.
Hezbollah is part of the Lebanese government. They have MPs inside, and they can manage to maybe adopt a resolution inside the parliament and then move forward with maybe attacking the Israeli vessels and their workers and so on, to push them away from their resources and their land.
Hezbollah chief also said that the U.S. and Israel are seeking to afflict Lebanon with hunger and partition. Nasrallah said the Lebanese companies that have pioneered to extract the maritime area's resources have been threatened by the U.S. and Israel, warning that Washington and Tel Aviv were after shaving off a large part of the resource-rich area. Lebanon and Israel took part in indirect talks to discuss maritime demarcation in 2020, but they stalled after Lebanon demanded a larger area, including part of the Karish gas field, where Israel has given exploration rights to a Greek firm. The talks were supposed to discuss a Lebanese demand for 860 square kilometers of territory in the disputed maritime area, according to a map sent to the United Nations in 2011. However, Lebanon then said the map was based on erroneous calculations and demanded 1,430 square kilometers more further south, including part of Karish. Israel relies heavily on gas and has long been developing a number of illegal offshore gas deposits in the Mediterranean Sea. This is a particularly sensitive issue for Lebanon, which is dealing with fuel shortages amid a worsening economic crisis.
And I'm pretty sure Hezbollah is wise enough to do this with coordination with other political parties inside Lebanon. Hezbollah does not want to control the country and does not want to push the country towards war, but they want to secure their sovereignty, they want to secure their resources, and they want to keep the country a safe country. And Hezbollah has been proven, with all these years, all their sacrifices and their actions. They're a very credible organization inside Lebanon and a political party that has a lot of good allies. And I think that this is a great opportunity, hopefully, to be able to get some more financial support for the Lebanese nation.
Hezbollah says it has the material and military capabilities that enable it to prevent Israel's gas extraction from Karish. The Hezbollah Secretary General has cautioned the Israeli regime against seeking another war on Lebanon, saying the regime's losses would be greater than those of Lebanon in the event of such military confrontation. This is not the first time the regime has sought to encroach on a nation's sovereign territory, but this time, the response it would receive could be unprecedented.
The U.S. and its Western allies have pushed ahead with the anti-Iran hysteria at the International Atomic Energy Agency in Vienna. The UN nuclear watchdog's 35-nation board of governors overwhelmingly passed a resolution criticizing Iran for failing to explain uranium traces found at three undeclared sites. The resolution rebuked Iran for what it has described as Tehran's failure to answer questions on alleged uranium traces at undeclared sites. It also accuses Iran of insufficient cooperation with the agency. The resolution excludes a recommendation to refer Iran's case to the UN Security Council, a move that would significantly escalate tensions and likely sink the ongoing talks to revive the 2015 agreement. The resolution against Iran is said to have stemmed from information within two quarterly reports on the country's nuclear activities that were circulated amongst board members last week. Iran insisted it had declared all sites which hosted past nuclear activities. The head of Iran's Atomic Energy Organization, Mohammad Islami, said Iran has no hidden or undocumented nuclear activities or undisclosed sites.
One of the main things to understand here is that the IAEA as an institution is meant to be, exactly as you said, a technical one. But now it is being used as a vehicle for political purposes in order to pressure Iran, in order to continue the maximum pressure campaign that the Trump administration wanted, with the support of Israel, to isolate Iran.
These fake documents seek to maintain maximum pressure on Iran. The Israeli regime has openly called on the nuclear watchdog to censure Iran's nuclear program. In brazen remarks to the Knesset, the regime's Prime Minister Naftali Bennett said Israel expected the IAEA's Board of Governors to strongly condemn Iran and make sure it will pay a heavy price.
So what we are seeing now is a campaign led by the United States, by Israel, and by European partners who promised that they would uphold the JCPOA and respect Iran and respect the deal and want to push America back into the deal. They are now turning around at the Board of Governors of the IAEA and pursuing this really regrettable, unfortunate, and downright dishonorable policy.
In response to the IAEA's unconstructive approach, Iranian officials have now decided to remove two surveillance cameras of the International Atomic Energy Agency from one of its nuclear sites.
And Iran now, we know in the news, is saying that they will not, if the IAEA wants to do these kind of actions, Iran will reconsider its relationship with the IAEA. And I think it is well within its right to do so.
Tehran says the two cameras had been installed voluntarily and beyond the safeguard obligations of the IAEA. The head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, has hit back at the accusations, saying Tehran has given accurate answers to questions posed by the IAEA, but the agency bases its reports on the information provided by the enemies of Iran. Iran had earlier warned against the consequence of the unconstructive move by the US and Europeans to disrupt negotiations to salvage the multilateral deal officially known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or the JCPOA. Iran has warned that it would give appropriate response to hostile moves.
Israel is the main provocateur of this current situation. The Zionist regime is dedicated to seeing a war with Iran. They see it almost as a holy duty. And it's not only extremely dangerous and reckless, but it shows the rogue nature of the Zionist state and of its backers in Washington.
The resolution comes as a pause in the Vienna process entered its third month. Tehran blames the US and its allies, France, Britain and Germany, for failing to act constructively during the talks. Under the JCPOA, Iran accepted certain caps on its nuclear program in exchange for the removal of international sanctions. The US, however, unilaterally abandoned the deal in 2018 and reimposed sweeping sanctions despite Tehran's full compliance with its share of obligations.
Since July 2015, when the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action came into existence, Iran's nuclear program has been open to inspections described as unprecedented in the history of the International Atomic Energy Agency. Under that agreement, Tehran voluntarily agreed to grant international inspectors easy access to its atomic sites well beyond its IAEA obligations. The agency was also allowed to install many more surveillance cameras at Iranian sites. The IAEA's inspections in Iran account for over a quarter of all agencies' monitoring activity around the world. Despite the close cooperation, the International Atomic Energy Agency is once again accusing Iran of failing to cooperate. This week, the IAEA's Board of Governors passed a resolution critical of Iran. The resolution was sponsored by the United States, Britain, France, and Germany. The agency says it is not satisfied with the answers Iran has provided to its probes of three sites. The resolution has been described as a blow to the stalled talks between Iran and the P4+1 group to revive the moribund 2015 deal. The IAEA resolution criticizing Iran was passed amid an intensified Israeli lobbying campaign to derail diplomacy with Iran. Israel is a sworn enemy of the hard-earned 2015 deal and makes no secret of its efforts to destroy it completely. The IAEA's Board of Governors passed its latest resolution just days after IAEA Director General Rafael Grossi visited Israel. Iran is also highly critical of the IAEA for failing to even raise the issue of Israel's nuclear weapons program during Grossi's recent visit. The atomic agency's credibility and impartiality are on the line as it seems to be yielding to pressure by nuclear-armed Israel to mount pressure on Iran.
But I do agree that Iran has good reason to be angry with the resolution, because it is an extension of the one rule for us and a different rule for you approach that's been taken by the IAEA with respect to Iran from the beginning of this entire issue. Iran has the right to develop nuclear technology. Iran has complied with inspections. And what appears to be the case here is that Israel and the United States are together attempting to restrict Iran's development as a nuclear power.
After years of unprecedented inspections in its nuclear sites, the Iranian government seems to be outraged by the IAEA censure. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi pledged that such measures will never force Iran to back down from its rights. Meanwhile, head of the Atomic Energy Organization of Iran, Mohammad Islami, says it is unfortunate that the IAEA is being exploited by an illegitimate regime. He demanded the agency put a stop to infiltration by Iran's enemies in its operations. As tensions between Iran and the agency soared this week, Tehran informed the International Atomic Energy Agency that it is disconnecting over 24 surveillance cameras that were installed in Iran beyond the country's IAEA obligations. Iran is also installing two new cascades of the IR-6 advanced centrifuges at its Natanz atomic fuel production facility. The Iranian atomic chief has said that Iran provided accurate answers to IAEA questions, but the agency lacks the will to declare Iran's answers convincing. Iran argues that the IAEA's focus on the country is discriminatory because it accounts for only a small amount of global nuclear activity and is undergoing hundreds of inspections per year. Negotiators from Iran and the P4+1 have held a year of intense negotiations to try to find a way to restore the JCPOA, but talks have stalled since March. The latest episode between Iran and the IAEA could further complicate the negotiations. Observers believe that the IAEA is pushing things in the direction favored by Israel.
Well, I believe that the resolution, which is primarily aimed at disrupting Iran's nuclear development program, is just part of a broader program of regional hegemony on the part of Israel. This program of regional hegemony has been supported by the United States in the past, and in fact, Israel was a prime mover in having the United States invade Iraq on the false pretense of weapons of mass destruction. I'm deeply concerned, and I must say I'm far more concerned than the IAEA could be about Iran's nuclear development program. I am much more concerned than that about the potential for Israel developing this issue via its supporters in the United States and via its own Israel lobby in America to bring the entire region into a potential state of war.
U.S. authorities are questioning Americans flying to and coming back from Ukraine. Documents reviewed by Politico show that the U.S. government is gathering information about Americans who are planning to leave the U.S. for Ukraine and are tracking their activities after they return. That only backs up reports that American ultranationalists and white supremacists are moving to Ukraine to join the fight against Russia alongside those Russia brands as, quote, neo-Nazis.
This is the model that we've seen play out time and time again, going back to Libya and Afghanistan and Iraq and certainly Syria and other places. And of course, we'll see it play out again, because ultimately, in my opinion, what's happening in the Ukraine was made to happen inevitably by U.S. policy. And it's in effect another example of a proxy war, in this instance, between the U.S. and Russia.
But it appears that the political optics of the matter is of a secondary concern to U.S. authorities, who see the country's national security at a greater risk. Documents obtained from the U.S. Customs and Border Protection mention six unnamed Ukraine-bound Americans questioned at the airport who were either war veterans or had had military training. Two of the six were carrying military equipment. At least three had links to far-right groups. Amid the recent rise in gun violence and mass shootings in the U.S., the country would see deadlier attacks if the perpetrators have the experience of being in an actual war zone. Numerous studies, including those carried out by the U.S. Federal Bureau of Investigation, refer to white supremacists as posing the greatest domestic terrorism threat to the country. The growing number of ethnically and racially charged attacks in the U.S. is raising fears that white supremacists trained in the Ukraine war could conduct even deadlier terrorist operations. Besides, many American citizens have traveled to Ukraine to provide military training to its army and militia, reinforcing the idea that Russian President Vladimir Putin's announcement that his country is fighting to denazify Ukraine isn't far from the truth.
To be sure, we've been seeing all manner of events play out for quite a number of years now that established beyond any doubt that there are some hardcore extremists taking the fight to ethnic Russians in the eastern provinces of the Ukraine. Thousands and thousands of Russians were killed, and President Putin, in addition to basically taking these moves to secure the boundary that separates Russia and the Ukraine, has stated that it's Russia's purpose to defend those individuals who are of Russian descent in the Donbas and in the Crimean Peninsula.
Russia has singled out the Azov Battalion, among other far-right Ukrainian paramilitaries, to bolster the idea that Nazis are within the ranks of the Ukrainian government and military. The U.S. used to agree with that, at least until as recently as 2018, when it banned the provision of U.S. military aid to the Azov Battalion over its links to neo-Nazis. According to the Washington Post, the Azov Battalion began recruiting far-right ultranationalist and white supremacist foreign fighters the day after Russia attacked Ukraine. The bottom line is, whether or not extremist Americans were sent by the U.S. government to fight the war in Ukraine, they're turning into problems for the country, both at home and abroad.
Thank you. This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's topic, the spring of noble emotions. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Have you ever seen how a house is built or a building is constructed? It's built out of bricks and stones. So where normally a person wants to make a shelter for himself, he builds a home, a shelter, a building out of stone and bricks. And we know about them, that they are pieces of matter, firm, rigid, inflexible pieces of matter that cannot stick to one another. So if you put a bunch of stones upon one another, they will not stick to one another, but they will fall away. It will be a dangerous place to be near them. So how we built a home, how we built a house, how we built a shelter for ourselves, we built it by putting those stones on one another, but not just the stones, because they are firm enough. They are firm enough and strong enough to build a home, but they do not stick to one another. They cannot create a bond with one another. And to build a home, to build a house, to build a building, a shelter, you don't just need a pieces of strong matter that cannot stick to one another. You need something to create a bond, to create a relation between those pieces of bricks and stones. And what is that thing? That is the what is called the mortar, that gentle and that delicate paste which you put between the bricks, and it creates a bond and relation between those things. So without that adhesive paste which can create a bond, a relation between bricks and stones, you cannot build a home. Together by bricks and stones and with the adhesive paste which can create a bond between those stiff, inflexible pieces of matter, that you make a home for yourself, you make a shelter for yourself. Scholars say that likewise, if you want to create a family, if you want to create a society with family, with sound family relations, we humans are also like stones and bricks. We have our own personal interests. We have our own autonomous interests. So we cannot create a bond to one another. We see that we are in a kind of competition to one another, in a kind of a race, in a kind of competition which makes us detached from one another. Welcome back. You are listening to A to Z. We were talking about the human relations and how result of our own desires and personal interests, how we are detached from one another, and how our personal interests make us vulnerable to not be attracted and not create a bond with our human fellows. So what's that power, what's that thing that creates a bond with another and make a society and a family a powerful unit? It's the emotions, it's the noble human emotions. There's like the paste, that adhesive paste that links the humans with one another. And one of the personalities and one of the human relations which is the spring and source of human noble emotion is the mother. Yes, she is the spring of noble human emotions. She's the one who sticks the family together. She's the one who has the power, who has the blessing that holds the family together. So mother is a gift from Allah. She's the gesture and she's the manifestation of divine love and divine care. So you can see in your society, in your family, that who is the most powerful binding force in your family, and you'll find that she is your mother. So she's a gift from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. If you have that gift in your life, please take care of it. Please feel like you have a great gift from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and take care of her. Don't never ever hurt her. And if you lost this gift and she's not more with you, please pray for her. praying for her will bring blessing to your life. And never forget that having her in life is a great gift. It's a source of divine blessing for us. And we all know that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala brings his blessings and his mercy to us through sources, through different occasions. And mother is such a gift that she's a source of divine blessing for us. I ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala that he give us the tawfiq and he may give us the will to take care of our mothers and to help us and to take care of us in a good way that will be the pleasing for Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Thank you very much, listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z on IRIB English Radio, Call of Islam page. To find out more about this program, log on to our website parstoday.com/EN, Call of Islam page. We leave you in Allah's care and goodbye.
In the limelight.
The U.S. Senate, with so many of its members in thrall to and funded by the gun lobby, will only posture, pray, hold a moment or two of silence, and then do virtually nothing. Dear listeners, this was part of an article written jointly by Amy Goodman and Dennis Moynihan researchers. This article is published under the heading, "The U.S. is bleeding from gunshot wounds." Here's the details. Gun worship is transcendent in the United States, with 400 million guns in circulation, more guns than people, and only cursory controls on who can buy or access them. Firearms are fetishized, celebrated, and brandished throughout U.S. society, delivering a devastating daily death toll unknown anywhere else in the world. This idolatry reveres above all else the semi-automatic AR-15, dubbed America's Rifle by NRA. In the wake of back-to-back massacres in Buffalo, New York, and Uvalde, Texas, both committed by 18-year-old men with legally purchased AR-15-style semi-automatic rifles, victims and their advocates are pushing for genuine gun control. But the Senate, with so many of its members in thrall to and funded by the gun lobby, will only posture, pray, hold a moment or two of silence, and then do virtually nothing. Kimberly Mata Rubio said in testimony before the House Committee on Oversight and Reform recently, "Our two youngest children, Julian, 8, and Lexi, 10, were at Robb Elementary. On the morning of May 24, 2022, I dropped Lexi and Julian off at school a little after 7 a.m. My husband and I returned to campus. At 10:30 a.m. for Lexi's award ceremony, Lexi received the Good Citizen Award and was also recognized for receiving all A's. We took photos with her before asking her to pose for a picture with her teacher, Mr. Reyes. That photo, her last photo ever, was taken at approximately 10:54 a.m. The teenage shooter arrived at school about half an hour later, and while 19 police officers reportedly hovered outside a classroom door for close to an hour, he methodically killed 19 children and two of their teachers. Today, we stand for Lexi, and in her voice, we demand action. Kimberly Mata Rubio, who works as a reporter for Ovalde Leader News, continued. We seek a ban on assault rifles and high-capacity magazines. We understand that for some reason, to some people, to people with money, to people who fund political campaigns, that guns are more important than children. So at this moment, we ask for progress. We seek to raise the age to purchase these weapons from 18 to 21 years of age. We seek red flag laws, stronger background checks. We also want to repeal gun manufacturers' liability impunity, she added. Zanita Everhart of Buffalo also spoke. Her 21-year-old son, Zaire Goodman, worked at the Tops supermarket and was wounded there on May 14th when a white supremacist shooter killed 10 people, all of them African-American. To the lawmakers who feel that we do not need stricter gun laws, let me paint a picture for you. My son, Zaire, has a hole in the right side of his neck. Two on his back and another on his left leg, caused by an exploding bullet from an AR-15. As I clean his wounds, I can feel pieces of that bullet in his back. Shrapnel will be left inside of his body for the rest of his life. Now, I want to picture that exact scenario for one of your children, unquote. On the same day as the hearing, the U.S. has passed, along mostly partisan lines, the Protecting Our Kids Act, which includes limited gun control provisions such as raising the minimum age for purchasing semi-automatic weapons from 18 to 21 and banning ammunition clips that hold more than 10 rounds, excluding those already privately owned. This bill is presumed dead on arrival in the Senate, where it lacks any chance of reaching the 60 votes needed to overcome the guaranteed Republican filibuster. AR-15s have enthusiastic defenders among Senate Republicans. Louisiana Senator Bill Cassidy told Vice they're used for killing feral pigs in the whatever the middle of Louisiana. South Dakota Senator John Thune said, in my state, they use them to shoot prairie dogs and, you know, other types of varmints. While Republican senators protect the rights of a few to slaughter pigs and other varmints with military-grade assault weapons, Ovalde's only pediatrician, Dr. Roy Guerrero, described to the House Oversight Committee what he saw in the hospital as he responded to the mass shooting, quote, two children whose bodies had been so pulverized by the bullets fired at them, decapitated, whose flesh had been so ripped apart that the only clue as to their identities were the blood-spattered cartoon clothes still clinging to them, unquote. The doctor ended by calling on elected officials to take action on gun control. You are the doctors and our country is the patient. We are lying on the operating table, riddled with bullets like the children of Robb Elementary and so many other schools. We are bleeding out and you are not there. We need a comprehensive assault weapons ban now, he added.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
Ayatollah Khamenei elaborates on 6 key points of Imam Khomeini's testament. June 4, 2018. If you travel to different Muslim countries, you will notice that their people have a high opinion of your beliefs, motives, and aspirations, regardless of their governments. They admire our slogans against oppression, the snake-like Zionist network and hegemony. They admire the chants that we have shouted in support of the oppressed and the Palestinian nation. This is what Muslim nations think. Their behavior is indicative of the spread of an Islamic revolution. As you can see, even our nation's views regarding nuclear energy, the fact that the Iranian nation resisted the pressure of the enemies and asked for its right, have been reflected in the Islamic world in a way that resulted in Muslim and Arab countries declaring the nuclear energy has turned into a public sense of urgency for all Arab countries. Both the friends and foes of the Iranian nation admit that the prophecy of Imam Khomeini rahmatullah alayhi regarding the spread of the revolution has been realized today, an instance of which is the Palestinian issue. Like the Iranian nation, all nations are sympathetic towards the Palestinian nation.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
Like the Iranian nation, all nations consider the Israeli regime as an illegitimate and imposed power on the region. Of course, many governments are not supportive of their nations. That idleness is exactly the element that strengthens Israel. The Zionist regime has no internal power to stand on its own feet. Today, there are two factors that have helped the Zionist regime to resist. One is the unconditional and shameless support of the US for this degenerate regime. And the other is the lack of support for the Palestinian people on the part of the Arab and Muslim governments. Unfortunately, most of the Muslim governments do not carry out the responsibilities in favor of Palestine as they should, and they are not harmonious with their people. The third prominent point, which is important to our nation and youth, in Imam Khomeini's testament and in the statements that he made during the last 10 years of his blessed life, is that the Islamic Revolution helps our nation progress.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways.
in the limelight.
The Guardian analysis has uncovered how American companies enrich themselves and their investors while boasting about jacking up prices. We now present you an article written by Tom Perkins under the heading Revealed: Top U.S. Corporations Raising Prices on Americans Even as Profits Surge. As inflation shot to a new peak in March, cost increases exacted a deep toll on the economy, eating into most Americans' wages and further imperiling the financially vulnerable. But for many of US's largest companies and their shareholders, it has been a very different story. One widely accepted narrative holds that companies and consumers are sharing in inflationary pain. But a Guardian analysis of top corporations' financials and earnings calls reveals most are enjoying profit increases even as they pass on costs to their customers, many of whom are struggling to afford gas, food, clothing, housing and other basics. The analysis of Securities and Exchange Commission filings for 100 U.S. corporations found net profits up by a median of 49%, and in some individual cases by as much as 111,000%. Those increases came as companies lumbered customers with higher prices and all but 10 executed massive stock buyback programs or bumped dividends to enrich investors. In earnings calls, executives detailed how even as demand and profits rose post-vaccine, they passed on most or all of inflationary costs to customers via price increases, and some took the opportunity to add more on top. Margins, the share of sales converted into profits, also improved for the majority of the companies analyzed by The Guardian. Economists who reviewed the data say it's more evidence of a clear reality. Consumers are taking a financial hit as companies and shareholders profit or are largely shielded. Krista Brown, a policy analyst with the American Economic Liberties Project, said, "It's obvious that corporations are trying to pass on any form of short-term pain they might be feeling, and that serving the top, wealthiest class instead of those in need of fair wages or products that are affordable." Media framing likely influences public perception. News reports of Hershey's multiple price hikes over the last year read like so many dire reports on inflation's pervasive toll. The company, which owns popular brands like Reese's Kit Kat and Skinny Pop, has been cast as the latest victim of ever-increasing inflation. But a closer look at the company's financials suggests a vastly different reality. Hershey's net profits spiked 62% between the fourth quarter in 2019 and 2021. Its operating margin widened, and it recently rewarded shareholders with $200 million in stock buybacks. The chief executive officer, Michelle Buck, told investors, "Still, customers will pay even more for candy shops in 2022 as Hershey aims for even higher profits. Pricing will be an important lever for us this year and is expected to drive most of our growth." Similarly, a Kroger executive told investors in June, "A little bit of inflation is always good for our business," while Hostess's chief executive officer in March said rising prices across the economy helps it profit. Lindsay Owens, executive director of the Groundwork Collaborative, which tracks companies' profits, said, "The pandemic, war, supply chain bottlenecks and pricing decisions made in corporate suits have created a smokescreen. She added that that obscures questionable price increases and allows businesses to be portrayed as victims of inflation. Lindsay Owens said that grey, nebulous area is fertile ground for companies right now, and you hear about it in their earnings calls. Inflation itself is the opportunity. The Guardian's findings are in line with recent US Commerce Department data that shows corporate profit margins rose 35% during the last year and are at their highest level since 1950. Meanwhile, inflation rose to 8.5% year over year in March. The Guardian's analysis is the first to take a granular look at a cross-section of companies across a range of industries in the United States. It compared the most recent quarter's profits to the same quarter 2 years ago, pre-pandemic. Price increases were obtained by checking earnings reports, though those often lacked specifics. The data is not intended to be definitive, but does show how a wide sample of companies have raised prices even as profits jumped. After earnings call, executives made no secret of their strategies. As gas prices soared, Chevron's 240% profit spike was part of the best two quarters the company has ever seen, prompting a dividend increase and assurances it would keep production low to maintain high prices. Steel Dynamics profits increased by 809%. The company was not materially affected by inflation as higher prices exceeded increased supply chain costs. Fertilizer giant Nutrien's profits shot up by about $1.2 billion on higher selling prices that more than offset higher raw material costs and lower sales volume. Nike's 53% profit increase, driven by higher prices, was only partially offset by supply chain and inflationary cost increases. The analysis found commodity companies trading in oil, timber, rubber, meat, wheat, steel and mining recorded the highest profit increases, while restaurants and retailers saw comparatively lower improvements or losses. Martin Schmalz, an Oxford University economist, noted commodity prices spikes reverberate down the supply chain, eventually hitting the consumer. He added, "The Guardian's data objectively shows a massive transfer of wealth from consumers who pay higher prices to shareholders and investment firms that reap the benefits." Even as profits skyrocket, many have dismissed the idea they play a meaningful role in inflation, including Larry Summers, a former Obama advisor with clout in the Biden White House. He previously called profiteering claims business bashing that are terrible economics. A Hershey spokesperson stressed that its growth was driven in part by volume, and it would be reinvesting much of its profits to meet growing demand. He said, "These investments are where we are making the biggest use of cash." Financial observers have varying takes on whether companies are profiteering or price gouging or simply profiting. George Parks, an analyst at Bespoke Investment, pointed to Caterpillar, which recorded a 958% profit increase driven by volume growth and price realization between 2019 and 2021's fourth quarter. Eliminating price increases may have dropped the company's 2021 quarter four operating profits slightly below the $1.3 billion it made in 2020. George Parks said, "This isn't price gouging, and it shows pretty concretely that there's a lot of nuance there," adding, "Profiteering is not the primary driver of inflation, nor the primary driver of corporate profits." However, he added that it's reasonable to question whether Caterpillar should have passed on its cost increases to its customers. Brown noted the company also spent $5 billion on buybacks last year, and $1.3 billion for a quarter of profits is still high, especially in the context of American workers' shrinking wages. She said companies have access to massive capital. They could have 1 or 2 years that are more painful, not even more painful, just less profitable for their investors, and they're choosing not to.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Eruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Said Pureza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Said Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Thousands of South Koreans gathered in downtown Seoul to remember the tragic deaths of Shin Mi-sun and Shin Hyo-soon, ran over by a U.S. military vehicle on their way to their friend's birthday party on June 13, 2002. The children's family's lawyer hopes for change in U.S. relations and influence on Korea.
The massacre of two middle school students is a symbol of unequal South Korea-U.S. relations. In that regard, I think that the work of candlelight among our people to establish an equal relationship between South Korea and the United States in the future and move toward peaceful reunification of the Korean Peninsula remains unfinished.
Two U.S. soldiers were charged with negligent homicide, but acquitted in a U.S. military court amid anti-American candlelight protests. The deaths of Mi-sun and Hyo-soon under the tracks of a U.S. military vehicle 20 years ago are but one episode of a problematic alliance relationship, from the Status of Forces Agreement to the cost of hosting 28,500 troops in South Korea. Alliance ties are a constant source of controversy and debate. Some argue South Koreans view the presence of U.S. forces as an obstacle, preventing the country from exercising sovereignty.
It's not fit for the global era and very risky for South Korea to cling to a falling sun with the status of American hegemony declining so much. I hope we can establish more neutral diplomacy reflecting our national interests.
New President Yoon Suk-yeol seeks to strengthen the South Korea-U.S. alliance, a shift in policy that worries many South Koreans. Frank Smith, Seoul.
Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi and his visiting Venezuelan counterpart Nicolas Maduro have signed a 20-year document on comprehensive strategic cooperation, which mainly covers a wide range of areas including petrochemical, oil, economic, tourism, cultural and political fields. In a press briefing after the signing ceremony, President Raisi and his Venezuelan counterpart Maduro said the two countries should work together closely in areas such as trade, economy, agriculture, as well as science and technology. They also hailed establishment of direct Tehran-Caracas flights as an opportunity to enhance relations and bring the two nations closer.
Venezuela has shown that it has put up exemplary resistance against the enemy's threats, sanctions, and imperialism. The Iranian nation, too, has been under numerous sanctions and threats for more than 40 years now. But the Iranian people have turned these sanctions into an opportunity to further make progress.
We will witness how the new world will take shape and how we will stand up to problems and secure progress. Iranian and Venezuelan youth should know that the future world will enjoy equality and justice and that we will stand up to imperialism.
Earlier on Friday, in an interview with Iran's Spanish TV channel Hispan TV, Maduro said Venezuela and Iran are on the front line of shaping a world free of imperialism and dominant powers. Maduro also hailed Iran's courageous move to send fuel tankers to his energy-hungry nation, saying Tehran's delivery of oil to Caracas was a great help to the Venezuelan people. Heading a high-ranking political economic delegation, Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro arrived in Tehran on a two-day state visit at the invitation of Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi. This is his second visit to Tehran. The first one took place about 6 years ago.
Both Iran and Venezuela have managed to withstand the economic pressures from the United States and have closely cooperated to offset the impact of the illegal sanctions, especially in their energy sectors. Saman Kujurip, Tehran.
In the Muslim-majority Indian-administered Kashmir, people observed a shutdown to denounce the derogatory remarks by two members of the ruling Hindu nationalist Bharatiya Janata Party against Prophet Muhammad. After condemnations by the global Muslim community, the two were suspended. Despite strict security arrangements, people in the summer capital, Srinagar, took to the streets saying they have tolerated everything so far, but nothing against their beloved prophet.
We demand stringent punishment against these culprits. No religion teaches intolerance. What we see growing attacks on Muslims and their emotions in India now.
These two people have dented the image of Hinduism on the global forum by speaking against the prophet of Islam. Scores of Muslim countries are today upset about India and its behavior towards minority Muslims. We have tolerated a lot, be it scraping of Article 370 or delimitation, but this time it's about our beloved prophet. We'll take to the streets without fearing any consequences.
In Srinagar, mobile internet services were suspended as a precautionary measure to avoid the snowballing of protests. Government forces were seen deployed in strength while people closed down businesses, shops and other activities. Last week, BJP suspended its national spokesperson, Nupur Sharma, who made anti-Islam remarks on a TV debate last month. Also, Naveen Kumar Jindal was expelled from the party over his blasphemous tweets about the Prophet Muhammad. The controversial remarks against the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, have sparked global outrage against India. The Muslim community across the world is denouncing the growing anti-Muslim ideology and hate crimes against the minorities in the country. They're accusing BJP of backing anti-Muslim ideology in what they call once a secular India. Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
There was no sign of pressure on the faces of those who run the European Central Bank when they met on Thursday to agree on bad news for hard-pressed mortgage holders across the 19-nation eurozone. Interest rates will go up by a quarter of 1% next month, most likely a half of 1% in September, and that's not where it will end.
Beyond September, based on our current assessment, we anticipate that a gradual but sustained path of further increases in interest rates will be appropriate.
The ECB manages the euro. It will be the bank's first interest rate hike in 11 years. The idea is to bring down inflation. It's now at a record high of 8.1% when the ECB's target is just below 2%. Rising energy, food and accommodation prices are hitting EU citizens hard.
Living in Brussels as well, the cost of living is high already, and then so if it's going up, it's even worse.
Everything is like, so you have to be careful, calculate like exactly what you spend on.
The people got some situation that they don't got enough money to go to the end of the month.
The EU mainly blames Moscow for the financial crisis because of the conflict in Ukraine. The bloc's justice ministers also met on Thursday to figure out a way of seizing the assets of Russian citizens without the need for a conviction in court.
It's a discussion that I've had also with our US colleagues. We are on the same line to try to see what is possible to do. But you know that we try to promote the rule of law.
Off the back of sanctions against Russia, the EU's economy is on its knees. Critics